so, well, the topic of this talk is what it says. It's a fast algorithm for approximating the SPD of the matrix. The basic goal here will be, say, compute the top several singular values of the matrix, also known as principal component analysis, and analogous low-rank approximation. We'll discuss what those things are as we get on. I want to mention that this is a joint work with Ida Liberty, who's here, I believe, Vladimir Rafa, who's introduced me, and Franco Wolf, who's back at Yale, working hard. This is a product of our applied math program over there at Yale. So the talk has the following points. First, we'll see some recent randomized work used in ours. There's been a lot of activity in this area recently, and I'll hit a few highlights of those. Then discuss just briefly, remind people what the low-rank matrix approximation problem is, and see how to solve it via the SPD, and also an object that we'll need during this talk, an ID, an interpolative decomposition. A little less standard than the SPD, but useful nonetheless. And see some steps in the algorithm, see exactly what the algorithm does, see what it does running on a computer. We've implemented it and tested it, so I'll show you some of those results. Now I'll probably sketch a proof of the accuracy bounds. We have some sort of theoretical result saying that the algorithm does work as well as in the direction of how well it works on the computer. And also then touch on some applications and give you some things to bring home about this algorithm. So I just want to start out by pointing out, well, Thomas Sarlos gave a talk earlier this week on largely on fast randomized methods for regression. So those motivated this. Also, there was a work by Alon and Giselle, which very directly motivated this. And I want to point out also that work by, well, many people, in particular, say, Jonas, Mahoney, and Muthukrishnan, motivated some of this work, largely through the work of Sarlos. All right, so what does this algorithm do? So let me specify that at first. And this is supposed to be a fast algorithm that also happens to be randomized. The speed is, you can characterize in the following running time. So the algorithm typically needs order mn log k plus m plus n l squared. And here I got to specify what mn and k are. So it needs that many operations in order to construct a nearly optimal rank k approximation. So think of k as small, as the low rank approximation, to an m by n matrix A.
Sorry, what is l?
And L, a good question. L is basically going to be like K.
Okay.
I'm going to specify later in the talk exactly what this means. Theoretically and experimentally, there's slightly different meanings to L.
But if I think of K, you want.
But if you think of L equals K right now, you'll be just fine. Or L proportional to K. You'll be okay. Okay. Theoretically, we need L be K squared. So that's a subtlety we'll touch on later. So that's that running time up there, which doesn't mean too much until I mention that there are classic algorithms for the same purpose, widely used. You probably use this to compute your principal component analyses right now. Classic algorithms include the pivoted QR decomposition algorithms. If you don't know what pivoted QR is, just think Gram-Schmidt. Everyone knows what Gram-Schmidt is, and this the use of the Gram-Schmidt algorithm for low-rank approximation is just what you would have learned back in elementary linear algebra. Now those algorithms, all pivoted QR decomposition algorithms, strong rank revealing QR, you know, Gram-Schmidt, Householder, Givens, they all take at least k times mn flops in order to construct a similarly accurate rank k approximation. So the observation that you want to make here is that, well, the classic algorithms take k times mn computations, whereas this algorithm is going to take log k times mn, okay? And then there's also this other term, and you'll see that this is also very much smaller than this.
How large are you thinking of as k in your application?
So k can vary. Basically, it should be bigger than 5, 6, and it should be less than 3/4 the rank. That's very ballpark.
And you're applying this to low rank?
That's what I mean by low rank, yeah. So it's any It basically means not the entire matrix and not just one. That's a rough idea. That's what how you should think of K. It's permissible to think of K as sort of much less than immanent for viewing these things, but in fact, it's more generally useful than that. Okay.
Are you assuming your matrix is dense?
Yeah, so the matrix here is dense. I mean, you could use it on a sparse matrix, but that would be sort of crazy. About a month ago, during the tutorials, we discussed the sparse version of this algorithm. So some of the audience has seen that. I also want to mention something here. This is a complexity estimate. You know, asymptotically, that's what it does. In fact, the constant that's hidden by that big O right there is not very big. It's about sort of the constant in an FFT. So in fact, this cost in practice is usually less than this cost, and often substantially so. So we'll see some examples of that later on. So let me pose or remind you just what low rank approximation is and remind you what SVD is and things like that. So this SVD that I'm going to be using throughout the talk, I'll use pretty consistently. It's not the full SVD, it's what people call economy-sized SVD or thin SVD or something like that. So here we have left singular vectors u1 through uk, each of length m, and we have right singular vectors v1 through vk, each of length n. And just k singular values, such that this matrix A is given by the standard formula there. And here, observe that the number of u's and the number of v's is just k. Okay, so they're a part of an orthonormal basis, but just k part, or just k vectors within them. Okay. So of course you can write that again as in the standard form, A equals u sigma v star. And here, just observe that U and V are not unitary during this talk. They're just subsets of unitary matrices. They're just the columns of U and V are orthonormal. Okay, so that's just your usual SVD. And the way you use the SVD in practice for in many applications is for low-rank matrix approximations. So statisticians in here are thinking principal component analysis. So those eigenfaces and everything that you saw there is are examples of that. Well, lower rank matrix approximation has the following property that if you pick an integer k less than the rank of A, then the spectral norm of A minus B, where B is rank k, is minimal with the value, the k plus first singular value of A. Okay? Sometimes people call it the Eckert-Young theorem, but you know, it goes back much further than that. And in fact, the minimum here is attained by this matrix B, in which you throw away all but the first k left singular vectors and right singular vectors of your matrix. Okay? So that's just the usual low rank matrix approximation principal component analysis. And why would you want to do this? Well, you've seen millions of examples throughout this week here, and I'm sure more in your own practice. In our own practice, we're using it largely for compressing subblocks of matrices that you get from discretizing smoothing integral operators. So operators associated with, say, the integral equation for solving the Laplace equation. So that's a scientific application. The standard statistical application is principal components analysis. And again, that's, you know, you can use it for noise removal, data mining, and many others. So we just described the SVD. That's one form of a low-rank matrix approximation. There's another form, which is, just as old, but not quite as widely known. And I'm just going to call this what our own group calls it, an interpolative decomposition. Some other people call it subset selection, I think is the older term that's related for this. And this is just, you take your M by N matrix A, and you get two matrices out representing it. So we're going to decompose A as a product of two matrices, E and B. So E is M by K, and B is K by N. And these matrices have special properties. So the first property is that some subset of the rows of E contains the K by K identity matrix. Okay, so there's an identity matrix sitting inside of E. And the second is that every entry of E has an absolute value of at most 2. 2 is just some fixed constant. I just picked something that was natural. It could be 5. Doesn't matter what you pick for this, but pick whatever you want. And points 1 and 2 specify that this matrix E is stable. E does not get too big. Okay, its least singular value is at least 1, and its greatest singular value is, well, not going to be any more than the norm of a matrix whose entries are all 2. Okay? So E cannot get too big. And that enforces a certain stability in this decomposition. It's similar to the requirement in the SVD that, well, the left singular vector matrix and the right singular vector matrix have orthonormal columns. Yeah, that's stability for the SVD. Here we have a similar stability requirement with points 1 and 2. And point 3 is why we call it interpolative. Why is it interpolating? Well, the rows of B are simply a subset of the rows of A. So you take a few of your rows of A and stick them into B. That's what your B matrix is. They're just the same.
Question.
Yeah?
You're assuming M and N are arbitrary?
No, M and N are just arbitrary integers. They should be bigger than K, but other than that. The algorithm that we're discussing today makes most sense when M is sort of comparable to N. Not that much bigger. Okay. Although it certainly works in the other case. Everyone knows about SVDs and that there are efficient algorithms for computing them. And for the IDs, there's a similar thing. So interpolative decompositions have similar algorithms. Sort of the key one here is an algorithm due to Gu and Eisenstadt in 96. And they provided fail-safe and quite efficient algorithms for accurately approximating any numerically low-rank matrix with interpolative decomposition. Okay. So if you have a matrix which can be well approximated by a low-rank matrix, then there is an algorithm which finds such a low-rank approximation in the form of an ID, sort of efficiently. And provably so. Now their algorithm, Gu and Eisenstadt's, is based on the Kramer rule. It's one of the strange uses of the Kramer rule within numerics. One of the few uses, actually, even. I should mention that heuristically, algorithms based on pivoted reorthogonalized Gram-Schmidt and other pivoted QR decompositions, they work well in most circumstances. In our practice, we've never gotten them to fail, although there are counterexamples, which don't seem to come up in practice. And these are a little bit more efficient.
Do they have an implementation of those? Is it fail-safe in a theory sense, or
they implemented it, yeah, and proved it.
So there's an implementation.
And they gave round-off bounds on it, so it's really proven.
So the implementations are that they have with their public available or something?
I'm not sure of that. Now, I just want to mention that the approximation that you get from this ID approximation is accurate to about the square root of the matrix size, so M or N, times the best possible accuracy. And the best possible accuracy, as we saw just a few slides ago, the best possible accuracy is sigma k plus 1. So the ID approximation gets you close. It's just sort of like root N times sigma k plus 1. So again, if sigma k plus 1 is small, well then so is going to be a root on sigma k plus 1. All right, so how does the algorithm work? Okay, this is the key step. If you know this step, you understand almost everything about the algorithm, with the exception of one thing that I'll specify later. So this step is, well, in step 1, we identify the range of A. So in order to identify that range of A, we test our matrix A on L columns of a special random matrix R. And again, think of L as sort of about K. So you're trying to do a rank K approximation. You test A on L vectors, on sort of K, order K vectors. Okay. For this talk, it's important that this be a specially constructed random matrix, and I'll specify that in a few slides. There's a lot of options available, and I'll just mention one during the talk. So here we form this matrix of Y, A times R. The one thing I want to say about R is that you should be able to, it should have some kind of structure that allows you to apply it fast to vectors. Okay? So R is a fast random matrix. You can apply it to vectors quickly. That's the only thing we need here. All right, and after you do this, so you test your matrix against some random vectors, the rest of the algorithm is actually pretty straightforward. That identifies the range. This is a little Y matrix down here. That characterizes the range of this matrix A. Okay, so once you have that Y, well, you can use the pivoted QR algorithm, Gram-Schmidt or whatever you want, the Gouin-Isaac set if you want a provable bound on what the algorithm will do. And you use that to now choose K rows of Y, which span the row space of Y to a precision about equal to the best possible rank K approximation, about equal to sigma K plus 1 of Y. Okay, and again, it's just pivoted QR will do this for you. And then you go to, so you take the rows of A in the same positions, and they will span the row space of A to a precision of about sigma k plus 1 of A. Okay. Now that's a fact that's not obvious and it remains to be proved. We'll prove it toward the end of this talk. Okay. And then, well, we're trying to build up an interpolative decomposition to our matrix now. Okay. What we did is we went into Y, we chose some subset of the rows of Y to build up an interpolative decomposition. And we went into A, and we chose some rows of A to build up an interpolative decomposition. So I'm going to give names to those rows. We assemble a K by L matrix Z from the K chosen rows of Y. So Y becomes sub-selected down to Z. And we assemble a K by N matrix B from the K chosen, you know, the corresponding rows of A. So A sub-selected becomes B. And then just using that same Gouin-Isaac algorithm or pivoted QR or whatever you like to build an interpolative decomposition, we construct an M by K matrix E such that E and Z together form an ID of Y. So they have the property that E times Z minus Y in spectral norm is about equal to the best possible.
That's what you meant on the previous slide.
Yeah, that's what I meant on the previous slide. So when we use this algorithm to form Y, we also use the algorithm to form E, and then we get this estimate. By construction, the algorithm does that. That's the property of pivoted QR, or if you want provable bound Gouin-Isaac. And then there's this sort of miraculous fact, though it should be fairly clear by now. Well, Y was sort of characterizing the range of A. Why? Because Y was A applied to several vectors, okay? K of them, and the range of A is supposed to only be about K dimensions big. Okay, so it turns out now, if you take those same corresponding rows of B, that so you took some rows of Y form Z. If you take the corresponding rows of A and form B, as we did, then this same E matrix that you get from here will give a construction of this form, approximating A now instead of Y. Okay, so E times B minus A in spectral norm will be about comparable to the best rank K approximation. And observe that E times B is a rank K approximation of our matrix A. Okay?
So just to check, you mean Gaussian bounds when you say approximately.
And that's the root n, isn't it?
Oh, I'll specify later in that talk. Yeah, the root n is sort of what I meant by that. But also it's in probability here.
No, I understand, but
yeah.
I want the problem.
Oh, this one's deterministic and it's enforced.
Right, but
this one's highly probable.
Yeah, and that's where I'm wondering about the Gaussian bounds.
Currently, we don't have strong bounds on this. We have sort of Markov inequality.
No,
Markov inequality type decay.
Can I mark?
But in practice, they work very much stronger. Yeah.
We have a theory meltdown here. Everything except this is clean. Experiments produce, there is a theoretical estimate. And that's what experiments produce. Here, the theoretical estimate is miserable, and the experimental data are perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And this should be supplemented with the fact that the sparse version of this algorithm, as opposed to the dense, we have proven the good Gaussian decaying bounds. It's actually, it's faster than that. So for the sparse matrices, we have theory that aligns very closely with the experiment. This algorithm behaves just as well experimentally. We have an analogous theory, which is not as strong as the one for the sparse one, but it does give some kind of bound. It is not in accordance with the strength of what appears to be true in practice. So there's some work to be done. And I'll specify more what that work is. But before we move on there, there's one part of the algorithm that was not specified so far, and that's this mysterious random matrix, which you can apply fast. Okay, so this mysterious random matrix is actually just a randomly subsampled randomized discrete Fourier transform. What do I mean by that? Well, it's this matrix R, as we had before. It's N by L, so it's tall and skinny. And R is the product, well, normalized product of three matrices, D, F, and S. Okay. Here, S, the rightmost one, is an N by L matrix whose entries are all zeros, aside from a single one placed uniformly at random in each column. Okay, so S just samples from the vector that you apply it to. Okay. F here is, F is called F for a reason, it's the N by N discrete Fourier transform matrix. Okay, unnormalized, that's not important. And D here is a diagonal N by N matrix with IID diagonal entries, each of which is distributed uniformly over the unit circle. Okay. And I want to mention that this is just one variation of random matrices. Which will work for this talk. This is the simplest one to describe.
This is the Alain Chazelle thing followed by uniforms.
This is basically Alain Chazelle. Alain Chazelle didn't use Fourier transform over the real numbers. They used Fourier transform
so
over minus 1-1.
Yeah, the physics version of it.
Yeah, yeah. So, and they also didn't use distributed over the unit circle. They used Bernoulli plus or minus 1.
Yeah.
But all these things are not terribly important.
So that your analysis goes through in those other cases?
Yeah, we've done the analysis in both cases. Also, I should mention that there's matrices that are actually quite different than this, which also seem to work well in practice. Yeah.
Sure, yeah, we see.
Yeah. Okay, so that was quite a bit, so let me recapitulate what the randomized algorithm is all about. So the first step is you form that matrix Y. Just take and form the product of A times that special random matrix R. So again, what's that special random matrix R? It's a randomly subsampled, randomized discrete Fourier transform, or variations. The second step of the algorithm was you find K rows of Y, which span most of the row space of Y. That's just, say, using Gu-Eisenstadt, or pivoted householder, or pivoted QR. And then you collect together these K rows of Y, the ones that span most of the row space of Y, and you form a matrix Z. Also, you collect together the corresponding rows, the rows in the same position, in A, and form that into a matrix B. Okay. And the third step is you compute a matrix E such that E and Z together constitute an interpolative decomposition, and they have the interpolative decomposition approximation property for Y. So spectral norm of EZ minus Y is comparable to the K plus first singular value of Y. And then lo and behold, the algorithm, you take your E and your B, they will constitute an ID, and with high probability, the spectral norm of E times B minus A is comparable to the K plus first singular value of A. Okay, so that's how the algorithm works. Now, many people don't like these. I like to work with things that they're familiar with, and SVDs are somewhat more familiar with than IDs. You have your choice here. They both have their advantages and disadvantages. In any case, you can easily move from ID to SVD and SVD to ID. So here I've just kind of thrown up on a slide the ways of doing this. It's just brute force linear algebra. So in step one and two, you sort of QR decompose E and B. In step three and four, you just take an SVD of some small matrix C, and then you reconstitute the left and right singular vector matrices. It's not important what these things are. They're just a whole bunch of simple identities. And if you put them all together, then your ID E times V is equal to an SVD U sigma V adjoint. Okay, so that should be no great shakes. Now, since our theory is not exactly as tight as our experiment right now, and we would like to actually use it in the, well, at least I would like to use it in the extent allowed by experiment. Here's a scheme that once you run the algorithm, you can check whether it gave a good result, okay, very quickly. And here's how you do it. So you take the difference delta between the m by n matrix A to be approximated and its approximation, and apply it to six random vectors, xj. Okay, six is just a number plotted and you fix. If it's 12, you'll get a better estimate of the discrepancy between A and the matrix to be approximated. Okay, so what we'd like to say is that the spectral norm of delta is small. If the spectral norm of delta is small, our approximation is very close to the matrix we're approximating at. Okay, so we've tested against these random vectors, and it turns out that if the spectral norm of delta is greater than 8 root n times epsilon, then at least one of the six numbers here, these Rayleigh quotients, so spectral norm of delta applied to xj over the spectral norm of xj, one of those ends up greater than epsilon, aside from a 1 in a million chance. Okay, if you had applied it to 12 vectors, it's in 1 in a million squared chance. So that's how it works. Now, if the spectral norm of delta is even greater, then, of course, your chance to exceed epsilon is even better. Okay. On the other hand, if the spectral norm of delta is less than epsilon, then all the numbers, just the classic definition of spectral norm, all the numbers in 14 will always be at most epsilon. Okay? So we have here a way of, with high probability, filtering out discrepancies, those deltas, with spectral norms that are meaningfully greater than epsilon. Meaningfully greater meaning sort of bigger than that, or bigger than something like that. And while always at the same time always passing all the discrepancies whose spectral norms are at most epsilon.
So that root n is the same as the other root n in your approximation factor?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Okay, and I wanted to mention, and actually did a month ago during the tutorials, that the Power-Langshaus method actually has better guaranteed bounds than the tool on the previous slide. When their operation counts are the same, they parallelize differently. And that's why I'm discussing this now. That's a fact due to Kaczynski, Wojciechowski, and Dixon. So a month ago, we showed exactly that was true. Here I want to mention that, well, the Power and Langshaus methods require successive applications of the matrix being approximated, as well as its transpose, to a series of vectors being generated on the fly. Okay, so it's in Langshaus method is iterative. That's what I mean by that sentence there. Whereas the method on the preceding slide requires only the application of the matrix being approximated to a collection of independently generated vectors. In particular, you could do it on separate cores or on separate microprocessors if you wanted to. So the scheme on the preceding slide parallelizes easily. And I wanted to give you a scheme for checking that this matrix approximation parallelizes easily, because the algorithm itself, if you look at the steps that for constructing our approximation here, that entire algorithm also parallelizes quite well. The basic step was we took our matrix and applied it to a whole bunch of random vectors. Or equivalently, took our random matrix and applied it to a whole bunch of columns of our matrix to be approximated. And that you can parallelize. You can do each column independently. So everything here parallelizes nicely. And just to rehash, now we can see where these costs come from. So this algorithm typically needs order mn log k plus m plus n l squared. So where does this come from? Well, to apply an FFT, which is sort of what our random matrix is, or a diagonal matrix of size n, you need n times log n computations. Now, we actually only need k outputs of our FFT, so in fact, applying that is just n times log k. And we have to do that to each, to each row here of our matrix. So that's m times n log k. So that term is just applying our random matrix to each row of our of the matrix for approximating. And then the rest was all dense, was all classic numerical linear algebra applied to matrices, each of which has one small dimension. each of the dimensions of the remaining matrices within the algorithm had either a dimension L or K. So L and K are sort of comparable.
So as I said, so L is K squared in worst case, but certainly
in theory.
Practice.
In
yeah,
practice, we're
case,
seeing that
in
K.
In practice, it's K.
Yeah,
plus
K plus 8. Seems
do you have assumptions
really
on A such that in theory it's K? Or?
No, no, this is. Oh, yeah, sorry. So the theory works for any A, arbitrary A.
Right, so you don't.
Yeah,
yeah, but you
there's
you don't
no
have,
assumptions.
You, no, but you don't have a statement such that given an A such that something satisfied L equals K plus 10 or whatever.
No, we didn't look at that. I expect something much stronger is true. I expect that that is true for arbitrary A.
So certainly, yeah, K or K log K.
In the sparse case, we have proven for arbitrary sparse.
There will be no K log K.
Yeah.
You won't have a log K?
No.
Yeah, but let's discuss that.
Yeah,
I'll say another bunch. And just to contrast that again, the classic pivoted QRD decomposition algorithms, they cost at least K times MN plus. By the way, the reason for that is that you have to pass through your matrix K times, looking at every entry. Whereas in this algorithm that we've discussed here, you pass through it once and find out what the range of that matrix is and then work within the range. So that's the key point. Instead of the classic algorithms where you pass through the matrix k times, viewing each entry, we pass through it once, you know, via an FFT, and then work within the range. Which, you know, if we're doing low rank matrix approximation, it's a low dimensional space. All right, so I have to now justify this claim that the constant hidden by the delta Bagel notation is not too big. Here's the proof. So here's the speed gain. This is what you do if you implement this algorithm. I have to mention that I'm going to give timings for this the algorithm during this talk. They're extremely conservative. You can accelerate. For instance, I've used a slow FFT. There's no real reason to do that, but I want it to be conservative. Even doing that, here's what you get. So on the vertical axis is the number of times faster than pivoted QR. Again, if you don't know what pivoted QR, just think of Graham Schmidt. That's all. Our QR algorithm I used happened to be Householder because it's usually a little faster than Graham Schmidt. And on the horizontal axis here, note that that's a logarithmic axis. I plotted the rank of the approximation. So that's K. K is on the horizontal axis. Now, of course, the classic QR algorithm is exactly one times as fast as itself. Okay, so it's a horizontal plot there. But the fast algorithm, depending on the size of the matrix, runs substantially faster. Okay, so you see, I mean, at 4096, it's getting over 10 times faster for some ranks. And it's pretty uniformly faster, too. So there's not a whole lot of reason to use the classic QR algorithm. And I want to mention, I'm being extremely conservative. So the time taken to verify the approximation, we showed the verification scheme. I've included that timing in the fast timings, but not in the classic times. Okay, so I've made the fast algorithm look as bad as it can be. And it's still getting quite a bit faster than the classic one. And then you might ask, well, how does the accuracy compare? Okay. And in fact, the accuracies, as I've mentioned before, are sort of comparable for the classic and the randomized algorithm that we discussed here. So here, I just specify easily what the matrix is. It's a convolution, 2048. You get similar estimates for other matrices, too. The best possible here, on the vertical axis is the accuracy of the approximation, the norm of that, the special norm of delta that we saw before. And again, we have a logarithmic rank k approximation here on the horizontal axis. The best possible approximation is the k plus first singular value of the matrix we're approximating. Okay, so this is as good as you can get. The randomized algorithm always gets within, say, a digit and a half of that best possible. Okay, so it's doing pretty well. You only lose like a digit and a half. Pivoted QR, it looks like it's doing terrible here, but actually it's not so bad. It loses basically 2.5 digits, maybe. And they're sort of, the behavior of the randomized algorithm is a little easier to understand, but the behavior of both the classic and the randomized algorithm is pretty good. They both get good accuracy. So I just throw out that this works, and hopefully it's intuitively clear that, well, if you identify the range of your matrix and then use that to approximate it, then you should get good accuracy approximations. But here's a quick outline of how to prove such a thing. So here's our stratagem for the proof. The first step is you apply the triangle inequality, breaking the accuracy bound into the sum of two contributions. One which involves optimization over a space of dimension k, so think of that as optimization over low-dimensional space. And the other requires the existence, and only the existence, of a good bound in a high-dimensional space. Okay. In the low-dimensional space, in step two, we observe that, well, two steps of our algorithm, steps two and three, optimize over that low-dimensional space directly via brute force computations. We just literally ran a GU-Eisenstadt algorithm, or pivoted QR decomposition algorithm, in a low-dimensional space. Okay. And then step three, well, we do have to get a bound in a high-dimensional space to get our accuracy bound. But we just need the existence. Okay. And there's two ways of getting this, from my point of view. One is to apply appeal to Alon, Chazelle, and Sarlos, put together their work for proof. And you know, I think we'll have a little enough time here to see, using their methods, how to get a direct proof of this. For our purposes, the proof is trivial, so we'll see how that works. So the first step of proving the accuracy bounds, again, we had to use the triangle inequality. So you have matrices all of these sizes. Remember, A is sort of the big one, R is our random matrix, and E, B, and P are all sort of small. And we just apply the triangle inequality here for equation 16. So equation 16 is literally just triangle inequality twice. Okay. And then to get equation 17, we just use the fact that, well, the spectral norm of a product is less than or equal to the product of the spectral norms of matrices. I've also used the fact here to get from 16 to 17 that B is a subsample of the rows of A. Okay, so for instance, the norm of B is less than the norm of A. Okay, so you just put all that together. That's pretty obvious. And what do we want to do? Well, we want to show that the spectral norm of A minus E times B is comparable to the K plus first singular value of A. So we saw that claim earlier, right? And here I'll justify. So I just duplicated the result of the triangle inequality up there. And then the second step here will be, well, step two of our algorithm chooses the rows of Z to be a subset of the rows of A, Y. And step three builds a matrix E such that E and Z together constitute an idea of Y. That was just what the algorithm did, step two. And you get this estimate. So GU and Eisenstadt gives you this estimate. So AR minus EVR is less than or equal to, remember I said the ID approximation gets within a root of the matrix size times the best possible, so that's what that is. And then the second inequality there is just a classic bound. Okay, so if you put together 19 and 20, so remember 20 is just a bound coming out of GU and Eisenstadt's paper. Put together 19 and 20, and the fact that E is part of an ID, remember, E is part of an ID, means that E does not get too big. None of its entries are bigger than 2. Okay? Because none of its entries are bigger than 2, spectral norm of E is not too big. Right? So putting together 19, 20, and this fact, just plugging it in, you get this estimate here. All right. So we want to get that right-hand side sort of comparable to sigma k plus 1 of A. That's the goal. I just duplicated it up here for that. But now remember that our random matrix is specially constructed. It's the product of a diagonal matrix times a Fourier transform times a sampling matrix. Okay, and well, you know, you can again take that the spectral norm of a product is no more than the products of the spectral norms. And, well, the norm of the Fourier transform unnormalized is no bigger than root n. The norm of our sampling matrix is no bigger than root l. And the norm of our diagonal matrix is no bigger than 1 because all the entries on the diagonal matrix have modulus 1. Okay, so So altogether, the spectral norm of our random matrix is no bigger than root n. And so if you put together 22 and 23, well, remember, we want the right-hand side of 22 to look something like sigma k plus 1 of n. And now it does, provided that there exists some L by n matrix P such that A minus RP is of the order of sigma k plus 1, and that this remaining term, norm of P, is not too big. Okay, so we need the existence of matrix P, which, given AR, will return our matrix A, a good approximation to it, without using a P with too big of a norm. Okay, and we just have to show that it exists. We don't have to be able to compute it as any part of our algorithm. So the key to showing this is what people in the know have seen before. This is something like a Lohm Chazelle Johnson Lindenstrauss backed. I think Thomas Sarlos calls this a lemma of this form a subspace Johnson Lindenstrauss lemma, which is a good name for it. And the lemma is the following. So suppose you have delta and epsilon are just small real numbers, positive real numbers, and k, l, and n are just positive integers, such that the following bound holds. So here's our theoretical bound. In practice, we don't need this constriction, but for our theory, we do. Okay, so here you see l is greater than some constant times k squared. Okay, the dependence on the constant is not so great either. In practice, it seems to work very well. This theoretical bound is somewhat, is much less tight than we see the algorithm running here, or empirically. Sorry. And also, suppose that U now here is a K by N matrix whose rows are orthonormal. Okay. Then the lemma is supposed to say that the greatest singular value of U times R is no bigger than root 1 plus epsilon. Okay, so it's very close to 1. And 1 over the least singular value of UR is no bigger than root 1 plus epsilon. So UR is a well-conditioned matrix. Okay, and this happens with probability at least 1 minus delta. Okay, so to interpret this in the Johnson-Lindenstrauss sense, for those who know what that is, and for those who don't, well, you can learn about it right now. when acting on the right from the row space of U, R preserves norms up to a distortion factor of root 1 plus epsilon. That's what 24 and 25 say. Okay. So again, if you hit the row space of U from the right with R, then you don't distort vectors in that subspace, in that row space, by more than root 1 plus epsilon. Okay. Their norms don't change. Oh, that's over. So this random matrix R has certain randomization in it. So the diagonal, it's just over that, is not randomized over the matrix that we're trying to approximate. That matrix is fixed ahead of time. It's just an arbitrary dense matrix, or arbitrary matrix, any matrix. Yeah. All right, so how do you prove this lemma? It's actually trivial. Subspace Johnson-Lindenstrauss turns out to be trivial to prove. So we need to estimate the condition number of UR. So a standard way of doing that is, look at matrix UR times its adjoint. Okay, and matrix UR times its adjoint turns out to be, you can just compute it to be, identity plus a matrix E. And the sum of the expectation of the sum of the squares of the matrix E is at most K squared over L. It's just a simple brute force computation. And not on the computer, on paper. So you just compute that. It's no bigger than k squared over L. And we had a certain constriction that I imposed on L and k squared. Okay, put that restriction on there. K squared over L is no bigger than delta times epsilon squared over 1 plus epsilon squared. Okay, so if you use the fact that the norm of E is no bigger than epsilon times delta times epsilon squared over 1 plus epsilon squared, then you can use the Markov inequality to say that, well, the spectral norm of E is no bigger than epsilon over 1 plus epsilon, with probability at least 1 minus delta. Okay? Okay, so that's where the Markov inequality comes in. Yeah. And now, well, we were, so I wanted to show you that 24 and 25 are actually true. How do we do that? Well, we have all the tools now. So if you put together 26 and 27, well, then the norm squared of UR is, well, equal to the norm of identity plus E, and that's less than or equal to, of course, 1 plus the norm of E. And the norm of E is no bigger than epsilon. Okay, so upshot, we get formula 28. The spectral norm of UR is no bigger than root 1 plus epsilon, which is also equation 24. And by estimating the spectral norm of the inverse, we, of course, get an estimate on the least singular value of UR. And that's just simply equal to, by, again, this equation here, it's equal to the spectral norm of identity plus E, inverts. And, well, you can use Neumann series or Born series if you're a physicist, and say that that's no bigger than the sum of the spectral norm of E to the J. Okay, so I'm just using the fact here that you can say 1 over 1 identity plus E is equal to the geometric series sum. Okay, so, and we know that the spectral norm of E is no bigger than epsilon over 1 plus epsilon. So sum this up, you get 1 plus epsilon. Okay, so that this equation 29 is equation 25, or inequality 25. Okay, so that gives you this subspace Johnson-Lynch stress law. And again, it happens with probability 1 minus delta. That came from here, Markov inequality. And I don't want to bore you to death, so the rest is simple but tedious linear algebraic manipulations. There's nothing tough there. Complete the proof of our current accuracy bounds. And the basic idea is to use that lemma that I said was key. In that lemma, you choose an orthonormal basis for the row space of A as the rows of U in the lemma on the preceding two slides. So the point of the lemma was that our random matrix applied to this, the row space of U, didn't distort the norms in there. So take U to span the row space, to span the range of our matrix A. That's the idea of the proof. Okay. We want to preserve the range of our matrix A. If we can preserve the range of our matrix A, and our lemma says that we can, then clearly we can approximate A well just by working within that range. Okay. So that's how that works. And I should mention, technically, the bound and the greatest singular value of UR is not necessary, but it's interesting theoretically. And again, I want to mention there's work to be done here. Our theoretical bounds require L greater than K squared, which is fine, it's not that big. But our experimental tests always succeeded with L greater than K plus 5. I think I used K plus 8 for the examples in this talk. So empirically, it seems like you can always run it in this regime and it works just fine. So that's where I would personally run it. Particularly because even though our theory doesn't guarantee that it works well, we always have seen that it works well. I've tried as hard as I can to get it to fail, trying different matrices and stuff, different matrices A. Once you run the algorithm, you can test whether it worked fast. So we had this verification check, and that it's really negligible cost compared to the rest of the algorithm, that you can run after each run of the algorithm to ascertain that it did, in fact, succeed. And it always seems to. Let's skip that. So again, just to remind you, applications, low-rank approximation, we're using it to build fast solvers for the equations of mathematical physics, but sort of more relevant to this workshop here is, say, fast principal component analysis on arbitrary dense matrices. So you don't need structure in your matrix to use to get this thing to run faster than the classic methods. So you should be able to do some noise removal with data mining on dense matrices faster than you used to. And just to summarize, what do you have to know about this algorithm? Well, there exists an algorithm, we saw what it was, for rank K matrix approximation. And again, that's basically equivalent to computing the top K singular values and vectors of a matrix. And it has some advantages over the classical pivoted QR algorithms, such as Gram-Schmidt, or Householder, Givens, whatever you want to use there. And the main point that I focus focused on in this talk is, well, it's substantially faster. You know, we saw some for some matrices, it was 10 times faster. Running on my little laptop here. And that was true for most ranks K of the approximation. So not just low rank, but sort of medium rank and almost full, and everything in between. And again, it even gives you a complexity reduction. So we have a complexity reduction for computing just several singular values of a matrix, or say several eigenvalues of a self-adjoint matrix. Okay, and it goes down from, say, n squared times k for an n by n matrix down to, again, as we've seen many times, n squared times log k plus n times l squared. And again, the l is k in practice and k squared in theory. We believe in theory it should be k. We have not proven that for this algorithm. Also, I wanted to mention, I didn't highlight it throughout the algorithm, but it is true that this faster algorithm also uses less storage, so less memory, when the input is degree preserved, especially for matrices evaluated on the fly. That's another advantage if you're going to work with really big matrices. Also, we saw that, well, this algorithm is randomized, but except for a sort of negligible failure probability, it reliably operates accurately on any matrix. So we can show it. It basically always gets within a digit or two of the best possible approximation. And something that'll become more and more important in the future, actually in the near future, as we get more cores on our microprocessors and as maybe a parallel computation becomes really prevalent, is that this algorithm parallelizes naturally. The reason, again, is just we took our random matrix and applied it to each row of our matrix to be approximated independently. You could do that on a separate core if you wanted to. So, any questions?